Secretary, come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. The first item on the agenda today, somebody had, the old agenda showed House Bill 2479. We are not hearing that today. First item is House Bill 20, public hearing on 2661.
House Bill 2661 modifies the distribution of proceeds from sale of certain property owned by the Department of Corrections. We do not yet have the fiscal or the revenue statement on this.
Is your bill camera?
I know.
Is this a work session?
It's just a public hearing. And we don't have a fiscal, so there's...
I just want to move it.
I'd like to see that go.
We don't have a fiscal, so we're just going to have to close the public hearing on House Bill 2661. No testimony to sign up. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2679.
House Bill 2679 authorizes a circuit court to expunge the record that a person has been detained for hearing, civilly committed, or recommitted for good cause. Applies retroactively. We do not yet have the fiscal or the revenue impact statement on this bill.
Representative Shields, please, and Gail Meyer and Alex Bassos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland. And this bill was brought to me from somebody who was involved with Project Clean Slate. And this person had a civil commitment and years later was just concerned that with this being part of the public record that it might adversely affect him in one way or another. And so he asked me to look into an expungement process regarding that. So that's the basic background of the bill. We have Alex from Metropolitan Public Defenders who has some expertise in this area, and he can tell you why the bill is needed, and I think he also has some suggested changes as well as Gail Meyer, who might like to testify.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. By way of the introduction of Alex Bassos, I asked him to come here today because he's probably the person in Oregon, we're both from Michigan, so we're sharing that story. The one lawyer in the state of Oregon who's got probably the most experience with civil commitments, hearings, and expungements. He's currently the director of attorney training at the Public Defenders, but prior to that, he was the chief of the special court section. He wrote the bench book on civil commitments for the Oregon State Bar, and I've asked Mr. Bassos to come and share his experiences and his thoughts regarding the bill.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to
argue. Could you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry, Alex Bassos. Sorry, the introduction confused me. So I'm here today to argue for a mechanism for relief from the permanent label of having been a person who was committed. Now, just to clarify, we're not talking about criminal commitment here. The commitment occurred as part of a criminal case, either to the state hospital because the person was unfit to proceed, or because as part of an insanity defense that wouldn't be affected by this statute. We're only talking about civil commitments that aren't part of a criminal case. The basic thing that I want to stress is that there is essentially a disconnect between the permanent label that's created as part of being committed and what the courts are looking at as part of the commitment process. So it's a permanent label in the sense that 20 years later, 20 years after your hearing, you can be prosecuted for being a person who has been committed in possession of a weapon, as if you were a felon. 20 years later, you can be asked about it on an application, and it can be held against you. 20 years later, it carries the same stigma as the day that you went through the hearing. On the other hand, as part of the hearing, the only thing the judge is looking at is how the person is doing on the day of the hearing. They're not creating any sort of permanent labels at all. Is the person dangerous to others, dangerous to themselves, or unable to care for their basic needs at that exact time, on the day of the hearing. So as a result, lots and lots of folks get committed who just need a short stay in the hospital. In fact, the average stay in Multnomah County is about 4 weeks on a commitment. The person goes back to the local hospital that they were staying at pre-hearing. They're released, and they never come back into the commitment system again. Think, for example, of the young 18 or 19-year-old who first goes through a psychotic break and doesn't know how to handle it at that time and needs to be hospitalized and needs some medications and stabilization for a short period of time. But once there is that stabilization, they don't necessarily ever need to come back into the commitment system again, and yet that person, 20 years later, will have that commitment essentially held against them and be stigmatized in much the same way. In fact, the great majority of folks that go through the commitment system aren't folks who are going through over and over. They're folks who really just need that short period of stabilization and medication. So I guess the one thing that I see that's really missing from the statute is what the criminal expungement statute has, which is a set of timelines. And the timelines, frankly, that are in the criminal expungement statute make a fair amount of sense to me, that if the state attempts to commit someone but there isn't the evidence there, the person ought to be able to get that off their record immediately. If the person is committed, there ought to be at least a 3-year waiting period or so to see whether the person really does stabilize. But after 3 years, if a judge can look at the whole picture and see that this is a person who just needed a short term of stabilization, after 3 years, that should be enough, much in the same way as the criminal expungement statute. And if a person is committed twice, then 10 years makes a lot of sense. Being committed two times is relatively unusual, and that means there are some pretty serious issues that are more than just very temporary. I guess that's my main pitch. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Stigler.
Thank you. You got to what I saw glaringly missing from this statute, which was any kind of a time period, which I would think, since we have a sort of tried and true system, I would endorse your idea that we do a dash one that incorporates something commensurate with the criminal statutes. And I guess my only other question is, if you're comfortable with leaving it in the interest of justice and for a good cause shown, I'm okay there too. But that can be a little bit vague. And I mean, I know there's case law, but it still sort of goes all over the map. So I mean, and that was going to be my other question. Are you folks comfortable with that as the criteria?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, members of the committee. I guess I would suggest, if I were creating the statute or sitting on part of a work group, which I hope will happen so that this statute can be made better, I guess I would suggest a standard with more clarity. Something approaching the expungement standard makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Okay.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your bringing this bill forward in your testimony. What is not obvious to me from the testimony I've heard today and also from the statute is the problem, the gravity of the problem we are trying to address by this statute. You referenced, for example, people being stigmatized, etc. What are the actual consequences of their having a civil commitment on the record in real terms?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, that is an excellent question, and one that, truthfully, I was avoiding intentionally. It's really difficult and to tell what the exact consequences of it are. Commitment records are sealed right after the hearing in much the same way that criminal expungement requires that criminal records are sealed. So commitments do not become part of the public record so easily, and I haven't found a lot of cases that where people are directly affected by public records which show that they've been committed. However, there are a number of very direct things that would be accomplished by this statute, even if the gravity isn't there in the same way as if the public record showed that they were committed. And the first and most important thing is that a person who is mentally ill can never get past this point where they were committed. It is anti-therapeutic and stigmatizing for the rest of their life. It is this permanent label that is out there. The second thing is that while public records may not find it or disclose it, you know, a person can't lie about it, obviously, and so any employer or renter can ask about it and then discriminate on that basis, even if it's, again, 20 years past the time where they were committed and it's no longer a situation in which they're suffering from the kind of illness that they were when they were committed.
Follow up, please. Thank you. And so it's always problematic when legislators start to, I think, legislate based on their own personal experience, but I cannot recall ever in my life having been asked if I've been civilly committed. Is that common in employment applications or rental applications? I really do want to help you. I'm asking you to help me show a need for this bill.
Members of the committee, I guess I can't argue that the particular need that that you're looking for is there. I don't think there are that many applications that ask about it, and public records don't necessarily disclose it. But that permanent label is still there, and it affects everyone who's been committed, most of whom get well after their commitment.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Even though something is allegedly sealed, I think we've all seen that there are instances where things still get out in the public record. And I guess if something has been expunged, you can more honestly look somebody square in the eye and say, no, this is not a problem. In fact, the courts have additionally said so. The person who asked me to bring this bill forward, unfortunately, we had a kind of a mix-up in the scheduling, and I was not able to make him aware that we had this hearing today. But I think what might be helpful is to see if I could maybe schedule a phone appointment with you to express some of his concerns around this area. Again, while it might not have, you know, kind of the horror story that we're trying to fix in one particular case, I think if you look at some of the challenges that people have come across, I grew up in Missouri, not far from Michigan, where this affected a vice presidential candidate in the early 70s quite sufficiently.
And I wasn't born then, Representative.
Reminds me of that all the time, yeah.
But those type of mental health issues, they get out, and they can affect people, as it did in that case of Senator Eagleton when he was potentially the vice president.
He had 10,000% support.
Yeah. Chair Barker, may I follow up?
Yes, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. The other thing to think about, I think, is the dynamic that occurs at the commitment hearing itself. So this is one of the primary things that we're thinking about as an attorney talking with our client about whether the person will agree to be committed. And if this permanent label wasn't there, I think you'd see a fair amount more people agreeing to be committed for what they know will likely be a short period of time. And you'd see less hearings. So it would be an inducement for the person to go through the commitment process, where now we have to tell our clients that it's a permanent label that you're never going to get rid of.
I'd have a question about, in the explanation we have, they talk about concealed handgun license and just buying a firearm. If you have a mental commitment, I don't believe they'll sell it. I'm not sure what the law is on that exactly, but I would hate to see somebody who was mentally ill taking their medicine and get off their medicine and you know, be able to say, no, I wasn't ever committed by a firearm, if they really shouldn't have one. And there are, it's
Chair Barker, members of the committee. And I guess the answer to that is that that's something that the judge would be addressing at the time of the expungement hearing. Is this a person who we want to be putting in that situation in the future? There are plenty of folks who weren't even dangerous at the time of the hearing, but 10 years after the hearing, you have such a long record of time that they're not dangerous and have been completely safe and are not ill, and maybe not even taking medications for many, many years. I guess it just seems too much to take every single person who has been committed and say that not only can you never own a firearm, but it's a crime to possess a firearm, even 20 years down the road when things may have settled out long, long ago.
I'm not aware. I'm not arguing with you, but I'm not aware that you couldn't own a firearm if you'd been committed, but I don't know that to be a fact. Representative Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, thanks. I think first to your question, the question that you raised, I do believe that does fall under the CHL law, so you're right. But my question then is there that many civil commitments anymore today?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, there are, I guess it would depend on your definition of that many. We're probably seeing 15 to 20 a week in Multnomah County alone.
Yeah. Wow.
And I don't know how many are in the rest of the state, but a fair amount. Multnomah County does more than any other county by far, but
you may.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, coming from Multnomah County, actually having been in civil commitments, not with Mr. Bassos, but yes, it's a daily occurrence. They hold the hearings, I believe, at least 4 days a week, if not.
All 5 days a week. And sometimes there are six or seven hearings in a day.
Okay, well, thank you, and I hope you get there somebody and maybe take a look at some amendments that might address the concerns. And I would ask you to take a look at the firearms piece of that. I mean, maybe they will not be able to have a concealed handgun permit ever or not. I don't know, but obviously, I see what you intend. Representative Shields are intending to do is help people get down the road, and that's a good plan. But obviously, you've identified some shortfalls in this, and I hope you get them fixed.
And I think it makes sense to address that, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2679.
It's a lot more difficult.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2713.
House Bill 2713 provides that all public safety officers are covered by the provisions of ORS 236.350, where previously only police officers were covered. It creates a detailed process and safeguards for a public safety officer who's under investigation, provides that certain investigations into an officer misconduct must be completed within 6 months of the allegation, and modifies the current procedure for an officer to request and receive a copy of a personnel record, and creates procedures for placing, reviewing, and challenging an adverse comment in a public safety officer's personnel file. We do not yet have the fiscal or the revenue statements for this bill.
Mr. Mackler, please. Mark. It's been a few years, but how are you doing?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be extremely brief. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, along with the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. Perhaps the chairman actually is more familiar with the history of this bill than anyone in this room. I know he's more familiar than I am. Mr. Mackler probably knows very much about it, but in essence what this bill does or is attempting to do, and we've been in the hallway having some conversations about a couple of technical points in the bill, and we'll try and touch on those that could be refined or clarified, but what it attempts to do is set a floor for the way investigations are handled of public safety officers in the state. You know that many officers have collective bargaining in the state, and provisions that are contained within this, in fact, may be a portion of their collective bargaining agreement once PECBA, public sector collective bargaining in the state, was established. However, there are a number of officers in either small, remote areas that either don't have a union or don't have either the political or the expertise to know what the standard should be, and this is an attempt by us to standardize what is the floor, what's the baseline floor for how, in these types of investigations, a public safety officer goes through this process. A number of other states have had this on the books for a number of years, California being one example. I'm sure Mark can probably give you some other examples. And with that, I'll be quiet and let Mark talk a little bit about not only the impetus of the bill, but the bill itself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as
Mark Meckler.
I'm sorry, I'm Mark Meckler. And I, my law firm represents about 125 different public safety organizations, their bargaining units in Oregon and Washington. We represent police, fire, 911, corrections, and then a smattering of probably others. And I know that the chair is familiar with that. The what you have before you in this House bill, let me start with this. As I was talking in the hall earlier, this is somewhat akin to kind of the necessity from our perspective of having to do something like a Senate Bill 111, which was the establishment of the officer-involved shooting protocols last session in statutory format. It is, from our perspective, an attempt to move towards, as was pointed out by Mr. DeLashmit, a floor or standardization and uniformity across the state with regard to public safety officers who are held to a, quote, higher standard and investigated on a regular basis for misconduct far more often than probably the other types of professions of public employees that we work with and represent. We have standardization in this state with the use of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. We expect that the members who get certified and licensed by that organization, 911 dispatchers, corrections officers, police officers, firefighters, deputy sheriffs, those types of people, are going to be held to a similar standard in their training, and that's why we have an academy, and we have a training system that supposedly makes the licensure say that they're trained to a certain level. And with regard to what we did with Senate Bill 111, we were trying to establish that when we investigate critical incidents, use of force incidents, which are shootings in a lot of cases, that we're going to have across the state a similar floor established. It doesn't mean that there won't be modifications to the floor, but it does mean that we will have the ability to have organizations and police administrators, public safety administrators who may or may not have the sophistication, the experience, the knowledge, and the training to conduct the investigation, to at least be able to reference a part of our law to say these are at least the minimums that the people that are in these functions should be provided as they move forward in these very trying investigations, because these are basically internal affairs investigations that lead to the potential of somebody losing their career, their job, being suspended, being disciplined. And that's what this is speaking to. There are a host of provisions in here that are provided as the minimum that we would suggest, propose, and that have been submitted as the way to treat somebody with respect, to treat them as a coworker, as an employee, so that they know how they are going to interact in the process, because the process varies. And in reality, Mr. Chair, as you are well aware, being subjected to an internal investigation is in and of itself stressful. It is a threat to your livelihood, especially when you're a public safety officer and the potential exists that there's going to be heightened scrutiny from the public, heightened scrutiny from the media, and that everything that you do is going to be Monday morning quarterback. Now, I can address specific provisions in here. There have been a couple that have been raised. One is the issue about whether or not a statement, it's in section 2, sub 4, a statement made by a public safety officer is not admissible in any subsequent civil proceedings, except, and then it lists some exceptions. And we had some discussions about this, because the intent of that, probably should have been written that way, is really to address the fact that it should relate to a compelled statement. These investigations are not discretionary for the employee involved in them. They are forced to participate in these investigations. They don't have a choice. They in fact, are subject to termination for insubordination if they refuse to participate in these investigations. They're subject to insubordination charges and termination if they refuse to answer questions when they're compelled to do so by their employer.
So that would be page 2, line 38. We're talking about a compelled statement.
There was also, I guess on page 3, there's been some questions raised about the limitation in section 7A about the 6 months in terms of a, I'll use my words, a cap or a limitation on how long it'll take to investigate something. And that, again, is put in there because the employee who is compelled and put under these presence of this kind of an investigation undergoes the stress and the long-term uncertainty of these investigations. And I can give you cases from jurisdictions that some of you have probably worked for where investigations have gone on for as many as 5 or 6 years before an ultimate decision was made about how that employee was going to be dealt with. And during that time period, whether that employee is on administrative leave or whether they're reporting to the office every day having to deal with the and interact with their coworkers who are saying, when's that going to be done, what's going on, that is a very stressful situation. And so with regard to the provision there, and that's on page 3 at line 13 and 14, no later than 6 months from the day the alleged misconduct was discovered, it's an attempt to address the fact that these be done timely and be get resolved in a timely fashion. I believe there was one other provision that was being asked about. Brandon. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Lashman reminds me. There was some question about whether or not if we have collective bargaining agreements where this already exists in terms of it's been negotiated into a contract. And I will go back to what I said both Mr. DeLashmet and I have talked about, which is the hope is that, and the intent would that this creates the minimum standard. There are lots of organizations in this state that probably have the sophistication to go beyond this. But there are also a lot of organizations, public safety groups in the state that don't have the sophistication or that don't have the experience, the training and the knowledge and the resources because they haven't had the ability to hire expert counsel or to bring in people who have the experience with regard to the types of issues here. And as I can tell you from experience, these issues that are codified in this bill are the issues that arbitrators, when they are looking at was discipline fair and just, frequently are pointing at and saying, you know what, employer, you didn't get there, and here's why. This is what you did. Your investigation wasn't full, fair, and complete, or you didn't treat the employee fairly in the investigation, or you hid the ball in the investigation, and that's not what this is about. It's about being open and transparent, and that is some of what this provides for. It provides an open, transparent system that everybody can say, at least we know, is a minimum floor to proceed from. And I will stop at this point and see if you have any questions.
Representative Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So regarding, I chatted with these gentlemen before the hearing to share my concerns regarding Section 4 on page 2, lines 38 through 44. So Section 4, A, B, and C. And they provided some clarification regarding that their intent was only a certain set of compelled statements. And I'm still deeply uneasy by it. In fact, the more I think about it, the less I like it. I do like the overall bill, and I don't think this particular section is critical to it. But I want to, A, get those concerns on record, and B, gauge both responses and anyone else's interest. So essentially, right now, a statement made in this kind of administrative proceeding, for it to be admissible in any kind of subsequent civil proceeding, that would be, it's an out-of-court statement, and it's either hearsay or it is not. It is not hearsay if it's not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. This might be a little technical, but if it is not hearsay, I'm deeply uneasy. If it's offered for a matter in the civil trial other than to prove the truth of the statement, I'm deeply uneasy that we are essentially prohibiting that from going into evidence. And indeed, I don't think that they should necessarily have an objection to that. The bill as written would do so. However, if it is offered for the truth of the matter asserted, that's a hearsay. And this, many of us have been in a courtroom. It's a fairly complicated piece of the evidence code. And there are a number of exceptions to the hearsay is generally not admissible unless it falls under one of several exceptions. If it falls under one of those exceptions, it would sure be currently admissible. This bill would essentially create an exception to those exceptions for a certain class of out-of-court statements. And then sections 4, A, B, and C, it literally would create an exception to the exception to the exceptions to the hearsay rule. And I'm deeply concerned about tinkering with the Oregon Evidence Code when that is not necessarily the primary intent of this bill. It makes me very uneasy.
Can you clarify where you're at?
Page 2, section 4 at the bottom, lines 38 through 44, section 4, A, B, and C.
Page 2?
Yes.
Okay.
Lines 38 through 44.
Oh, okay. Same place they were at before. So
and I don't think this is integral to the bill, but if we're going to tinker with the evidence code, I think we should do so separately and apart from it, and also very deliberately and intentionally.
In these hearings... In this kind of a hearing, for where it doesn't apply to other people, is I want to ask you a question, and you say, I'm not going to answer it, or you can lie or whatever. These are compelled statements. You
right.
have to answer. You can't say, I choose not to answer it, or you're fired. You can't say, you can't lie, or you're fired.
Right.
You have to. This is a very coerced statement. It isn't.
Right.
And that's why the protection against the, Is it transactional immunity? Is that
well, right? Chair
Barker, you can probably answer
I'd love to respond when I get a chance.
If you want, I can. This relates to an issue that is exactly what you just said, which is that we have in this state some very mixed case law about what is called transactional and derivative immunity. Soriano, there's some case law about this, and in fact, it is constantly the source of lawyers arguing with each other, both, I would say, from my side of the table and the other side of the table, employer and employee type of litigation on this issue. It comes from the fact that, as Mr. Chairman, as you pointed out, that that when you are in this situation, you are absolutely expected, with no option, to answer a question about what your conduct was, what you omitted to do, how you proceeded, who you had contact. There are a host of things, and in that situation, we typically call what that requires generally, especially if there's potential criminal exposure, is what we call a reverse Garrity warning. Garrity being a United States Supreme Court case that basically says, because I'm going to compel you to talk and order you to do so, then what I get out of that you can't be used to prosecute you criminally. It can be used specifically to prosecute you civilly, assuming that you're not going to go to jail under a federal 1983 action, because that's a quasi-criminal action. But civilly, you can be sued for damages. You can be administratively prosecuted, meaning you can lose your job. You can lose your license. DPSST can take your certification away. It can be used for all of those purposes. And although this is probably not as artfully written as it could have been, the exceptions that it's referring to here are trying to maintain those exceptions. It can be used for a civil sanction against the officer. In other words, they can be fired. They can be fined, disciplined. It can be used in other administrative proceedings. It can be used to impeach the testimony in any proceeding, because obviously if the way it's written, if the employee at issue had said, this guy is blue, and then later on in court testimony they say, no, it was red, you absolutely can bring that statement in to impeach them. It does not take away those prohibitions. It does not strip that from the evidence code. Could it have been written a little bit more artfully? Probably so. But that's why we do this process. So.
I have an artful lawyer here.
Hey, Mr. Chair, actually, I'm pulling a play out of Representative Smith's playbooks. I would have 3 points in response to this. First of all, very interesting discussion. Number one, all of our discussion here is assuming that the statements made by the officer in the administrative party, that that officer is somehow a subject or indeed party to the subsequent civil proceedings. As written, it bans, let's pretend I'm an officer and I make some statements. Let's then pretend Representative Stigler sues Representative Garrett. Even my statements would be inadmissible in the trial between them. That could be many reasons why it's relevant in subsequent civil trials in which even I, the officer who made the compelled statement, has no particular interest whatsoever. So that's point one. Point two is that, again, what if the statement, compelled or otherwise, is not offered in the subsequent civil trial for the truth of the matter asserted? It could be offered for many reasons, to show practice, there is an almost infinite number of reasons why it could be relevant and necessary, and really not in any way compromise the officer who made the statement, even if he were a party to it. Number three, this statement, such a statement, would be hearsay. Hearsay is presumed inadmissible unless it falls into one of several exceptions. The Oregon Evidence Code, Rule 803, already supplies protections that I think are more than adequate. And if we're going to start creating exceptions to the exception, and then indeed an exception on top of that, it makes me very, very nervous. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Barnes,
I don't want to undermine the whole bill just based on this one minor section.
I understand you saying that. And do you see a way that you would be able to, you think, make adjustments that would take care of your concerns in this matter?
Mr. Chair, I think we could make adjustments that would certainly mitigate my concerns. I don't know if they could be entirely removed because, again, frankly, I think the evidence code already has the protections in place.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, how many agencies do you represent? Please, law enforcement agencies.
In total?
Yes. Here in Oregon.
I'm going to take it's probably more than 80.
80?
Yeah. I could have you go to my website and you could count, but I don't have it.
Okay. How many agencies outside of that, then, do you feel probably aren't represented right now?
Aren't represented?
Uh-huh. Throughout the state.
You mean in terms of have...
Don't have any representation at all.
I actually don't know.
Okay.
Chair Barker and Representative, I don't know the answer to that. I know that it still exists.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair. Of those agencies that you represent, do they have policies in place right now that deal with this?
It is a hodge... Chair Barker and Representatives, it is a hodgepodge. There are policies that exist that talk about how to conduct a discipline investigation, but the detail of those is very scattered and extreme. The Oregon State Police might very well have a discipline manual about how to do it, but even with having a discipline manual, the application that the state police might have in the way they do it in Coos Bay as opposed to how they do it in Baker City is actually fairly diverse. Some of that has to do with training. Some of it has to do with personalities. And again, this will not change training and personalities. Comparatively, when you look at the discipline manual for the Oregon State Police versus the way that the policy is written for the Malheur County Sheriff's Office, they are completely different animals. They are completely different constructs. And the fact that Sheriff Bentz in Malheur County might very well say, we treat people fairly, and so when you talk to them, just be considerate and nice and ask them questions and... doesn't mean that there is a protocol in place for every single one of those issues, unfortunately. I'm not necessarily giving you a very black and white answer here because even the collective bargaining agreements that I directly have impact on and work with are very scattered in terms of these types of provisions being in those collective bargaining agreements. Clackamas County, just with a group that I represent there, the probation and parole officers, who would be covered under this bill, just recently, just this last 6 months, have finally put an investigative protocol together for how they're going to conduct internal investigations. It's a major county, metropolitan county. Contrast that in the sheriff's office in Clackamas County, they have had those protocols in place for a number of years. So even internally within the organization, where you have different public safety entities, they are doing things completely differently. In that case, the right hand and the left hand didn't know what each other was doing. Am I answering the question?
Well, actually, you answered about two or three other questions that I had. Okay. So you did really well. Okay. But just one other question, Mr. Chair. Page 3, and it would be Section 2, Sub 7, that you talked about a little bit for the exceptions. Most agencies don't have this.
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, in terms of do most agencies not have a timeline?
Right.
No, they don't. In fact, we struggle. I would say this is probably one of the biggest struggles, which is getting an employer to in the collective bargaining agreement or in that arena to agree that timely investigations should not be dragged out. Now, I think as you're aware, the protocol in the state police system is such that the investigation is supposedly supposed to be concluded within 45 days, and if not going to be concluded within 45 days, we get what we call the 14-day extension letters, and I have many state police files that have stacks and stacks of 14-day extension letters for investigations that have gone on for many, many, many months and years. This does not exist. It's not timely investigation stuff. There's probably a host of reasons why. The argument about use of resources, time, money, dedicating one specific investigator to do a full, fair, and complete investigation takes a lot of time. And when you're dealing with an agency the size of Hermiston or the size of Vernonia, and you're trying to also provide police services and public safety enforcement and other, you may not have it. You may have it in the state police or in the city of Portland or in Hillsborough, but again, as we move into organizations that are less sophisticated or that have less resources available to them, they don't have these types of provisions in there. And so the priority of getting this done does not necessarily follow through.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. And I don't believe I was pre-briefed by the opponents or supporters or on this issue. I'm really confused about the bill. I represent a police district of about, six people at Sun River, and I'm not sure that this is good. I'm confused because we start off by saying this is what an internal affairs office. I think the testimony was this is sort of what concerned internal affairs. I don't think we have an internal affairs department in Sun River. And so I don't mind, and I also listened to the testimony that this is in the contracts, and that's fine, and that's where it should be. And I don't mind supporting some baseline directives, but this seems to cross over baseline and get too specific, too close to where the contract should be. So these are concerns I have. I'll be glad to try to listen and see if things can work out, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, maybe I'll respond very briefly before Mr. Mackler does. One is I could not offhand tell you whether or not Sun River does have a collective bargaining agreement or doesn't have one. So they may be one of those that doesn't even have a collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, they wouldn't have any any standards written into their collective bargaining agreement.
I hope, Mr. Chair, I disagree. But if that police chief doesn't have directives, then I'm going to be sure he will, or he's going to get replaced, because that's, you should have written directives and policies for the police officers.
The second response that I would have, Mr. Chair and Representative, is that sorry, I've just lost my train of thought now. I'll think of it in a minute. I'll let Mark respond. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, let me first offer you full disclosure. I represent the Sun River Police Officers Association.
Okay.
And specifically, I bargained the contract that they have now that is a... and they are on the management side, they are represented by Bruce Bischoff.
Yeah.
So, and I am familiar with Chief Kennedy and the group there, and so I actually can speak to this for you. We actually dealt with this particular issue as a necessity when we, because they are in their very, very, very first contract.
Yeah.
Never had a contract until, I believe, 2 years ago. Prior to that, really, there were not investigative protocols in place when they didn't have a collective bargaining agreement. They had a, again, as I had kind of characterized, they had a hodgepodge of issues, because when I went in there and we sat down, and I sat down with the people who are Paul Moore and Christina Gage, who I'm sure you are familiar with, and we sat down with Chief Kennedy trying to get to yes with the board, the Sun River board. Part of what we discovered was the process that they used to do an investigation, which I called an internal affairs investigation. It's called lots of things, a disciplinary investigation, internal investigation. And I want to make sure that you didn't misunderstand what I said. I wasn't saying that all these agencies have internal affairs divisions or departments. They don't. In fact, part of what I was trying to get at is, and Sun River is a perfect example, in an agency with 10 police officers, somebody gets, when somebody commits a misdeed or a bad act, and then it's got to be investigated, Chief Kennedy does one of these things. Okay, let's see, it's your turn to do the investigation. And that person who he just pointed at may or may not have any training, experience, or knowledge of how to do so, and all of a sudden is tasked with, how do I do this? What do I got to do to make sure I collect all the facts, I get all the evidence, I do it the right way, and I don't have potentially on the back end of this thing somebody saying I did it wrong, and so whatever we concluded is going to be reversed. And so this document, this bill that we've proposed, gives that person, whoever happens to be pointed at, again, a baseline place to go to say, okay, well, at least if I do these, I know I'm going to meet the minimum process criteria that's going to safeguard at least having done this in a full, fair, and complete way. And stop there.
All right. Are these procedures and the rules that they have now, are they the same for someone that's late for duty and not dressed properly as they would be for someone who has abused their power or use their weapon illegally? This is where I'm having a problem with trying to do a statewide, and I would expect as a commander or police chief of an organization, they should have all those areas covered locally and how they can handle it. And I'm not against training assistance and training manuals for those officers that he points out to be able to go to and pull out, but I'm just not sure I can see why we need one at a state level. This detail... for statewide.
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnett, let me see if I can rephrase what I'm hearing you ask. I think the question you're asking is, I think in generic terms what you're saying is, does it apply to any kind of investigation regardless of whether it's excessive force or tardiness? Is that what I'm... And I believe that what you see here is it focuses on the seriousness of the investigation. Now, I think the short answer could be sure if the department wants to do that. But the reality is that what you're talking about then when you're asking those questions is different. Those different types of things are dealt with through potentially supervisory counseling. It kind of goes into some other things, supervisory counseling or some other.
Talking about disciplinary and just cause, so disciplinary would not be. It could be.
When an officer's called in and there's some issue, you're facing potential disciplinary action, and if you have a union representative, normally at that time you would go get your union rep to be there. And this law actually came out of a horrendous investigation in Portland in the mid-70s, where everything was done as bad as you could do it, where they lied to the officers, they had to meet them at motels. I mean, it was just a disaster, and the Portland Police Association really fought to get some standards. And then there was an effort to have this statewide to provide that before you could fire somebody, you had to have just cause, because there was political firings going on. There was a small department on the coast where some officers wanted to form a police association. They were fired illegally. They had to hire them back. Then they were fired again because he saw them use the typewriter or something. I mean, it was that kind of thing. So that's when this came about. At one time, both houses of this legislature in 1995 passed this bill. And Governor Kitzhaber vetoed the bill. And I never could get an explanation about that, why he vetoed it. There, to save some time, I think Representative Barton has brought up some good points. We'll need to take a look at that. I'm concerned, and I spoke with Chief Sizer yesterday about the six-month limitation, because there's some exceptional cases that are going to go beyond that, and nobody, especially the police associations who face the wrath of the public if one of theirs goes off the reservation, don't want a bad officer to escape thorough discipline. And as you may remember, I worked internal affairs as well. I've been on the union side of it for 20 years, and I was actually an investigator in internal affairs in Portland. And sometimes we would have cases that weren't getting started for 2 years. And it is awful to have that hanging over an officer. They want resolution. So it's good to have some kind of a tail end on it. But there needs to be an exception so that we don't have some extraordinary case where it gets off. But what this law is intended to do is set a baseline so that every officer in Oregon, every licensed, if you will, DPSST certified officer, has some kind of a base they can expect. And sometimes it isn't the small chief's exactly their fault that they don't know what they're doing, because they may have come out of some little department in California, get hired at some little tiny town in Oregon, and this would just give them a good guidance, and that's the intent of it, just to set a baseline. People can negotiate contracts that are more restrictive, and that would, you know, whatever, that's up to the parties involved. But is that a fair summary?
Chair Barker, I think that, yes.
Okay. And so we have some work to do on the bill. I'm sorry, Representative Barton.
Just a question of fact for you. And did the Governor Kitzhaber veto this bill as written currently, or is it a different bill?
It might be a different bill. Mm-hmm. I don't remember, but it was in 95.
But it was substantially similar, I gather.
Rights. Yes. Yeah. It was similar. And the main thing we were shooting for there, because at that time there were still problems, Senate Bill 750 was in the mix of that, was there was officers that we thought were being fired around the state without just cause. We wanted to have just cause standards for that. Representative Olson.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Jeez, Mayor. Thinking of...
He's judge. He's mayor.
Portland. Yeah, you got me.
Your Honor.
Obviously, then, for the agencies that are already in compliance with this, I mean, that mirror something similar to this, they're okay.
No impact.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Marilyn Arantz and David Barenberg.
Reinhardt.
No.
He's supposed to be testifying to the police chiefs.
Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I also know that Kevin Campbell from the Police Chiefs Association would like to join
That'd
us if
fine.
That's possible.
Please.
For the record, my name is Marilyn Lorantz. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Chair Barker and members of the committee, in general, House Bill 2713 relates to employer and employee processes that are outside the scope of our department's responsibilities. However, those processes overlap with DPSST in the limited cases when we conduct a professional standards investigation, when the conduct is related to a matter that had included an employer-employee investigation. So when this bill was scheduled for a hearing, our agency wanted to review the language of the bill. One provision of the bill, which has already been discussed this afternoon, which is Section 2, Subsection 4, caused us some concern, as it wasn't clear to us whether there would be an unintentional impact by virtue of the phrasing of that section to our administrative processes. So we asked the Department of Justice Counsel to review the bill for us, and they confirmed our concern for the reasons that I will briefly try and describe to you to place on the record. ORS 181-675 is a DPSST statute that requires employers to provide us with access to personnel records when those records are related to a professional standards investigation that DPSST is conducting. And those records and DPSST's actions and subsequent processes are all administrative in nature. Section 2 sub 4 of the bill that's before you this afternoon provides that statements by a public safety officer are not admissible in a subsequent civil proceeding.
They admitted they left out the word compelled, the compelled testimony.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Department of Justice Counsel confirmed for us that civil and administrative proceedings are generally distinct, subject to different laws and rules, and so that in general, that exception for subsequent civil proceedings would not pertain to DPSST administrative actions. However, paragraph B in that subsection uses the term administrative or other proceedings in one of the exceptions to the exemption. Because of that, Department of Justice Counsel was concerned that there could be an unintended confusion because of the rolling of the term administrative proceeding into that broader description of civil proceedings that's in the header language in subsection 4. We called committee counsel, who recommended that we come to the committee, place our concern on the table, and just leave it with you that there is some confusion that would perhaps have an unintended consequence for our administrative proceedings.
Thank you very much for taking the time to bring that to us. Mr. Barenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland. And first thing I'm going to do is apologize for not being Captain David Famous of our Internal Affairs Division, who would have liked to have been here but actually is in a hearing today.
And that's his real name.
That's a great name. And Captain Famous.
Great name.
Should have a cape. We appreciate having met with the chair and expressed some concerns, and we have a few other concerns which are more technical in nature too with the bill, and also meeting with some of the members yesterday had got us to thinking of some other things. But specifically, the city's greatest concern is one that I know the chair shares and we've talked to the bill's proponents about addressing, is the issue of the six-month limitation on investigations. Portland has seven full-time investigators, has a goal of trying to close cases within 70 days. After 70 days, the investigators meet with the captain in charge of the division to find out why it's taking more than 70 days. The case takes more than 180 days. Now they meet the captain meets with one of the assistant chiefs to find out why it's taking more than 180 days. Though there are a number of cases, some may involve officer-involved shootings or a death of somebody in police custody, might have many witnesses and just be very complicated. Occasionally, too, if there are a number of fairly complicated cases, and those complex cases have two investigators assigned to them, major cases, some other cases may end up being delayed, which is not the norm, but sometimes happens. So we would appreciate having an extension on the time that's included there. The issue that Representative Barton raised in terms of the language and the broadness, and it was one that was also flagged, and even with the term compelling, there's still a concern that it may still be a little too broad and how it is applied. The other, just a couple points to mention quickly, or more just in some language that our counsel on further review overnight thought just add some ambiguity and could be tightened a little bit. And, you know, an example of that is there's the term that that you have to have a notify an officer before putting an adverse comment in the personnel record. And just counsel's concern was, what does adverse comment mean? Is it, could it be construed to mean writing a comment in a planner saying, you are late today, don't do it again? And, you know, something fairly minor and probably not contemplated. So it's just more of an issue of trying to hone in on what a more appropriate definition of the term might be. And with that, I would end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I wanted to share basically just a couple concerns we have about the bill as written, and they're actually broader concerns, and so I don't know how helpful they'll be to the committee. My least favorite bills to lobby in the legislature are collective bargaining bills, and the reason for that is that since the passage of 750, it seems like management labor has been in an all-out battle every session over everything. There has been really no way for us to sit down, or we haven't been able to sit down and really negotiate out the details of a process that's pretty critical to police officers and to the cities and counties that employ them throughout the state. I guess on this bill, I wanted to just share not over strongly, but just share a concern, a philosophical concern, and then a process concern. I did get a chance to talk to Mr. Mackler and Brian. I find those conversations very helpful. I think that it's important for us to do more of that, not less. That being said, my philosophical concern really has to do with any bill where we try to put the language that's currently negotiated in bargaining negotiations into statute. I do think there are exceptions to that. I think there are times when the state has a compelling interest to take a look at something that they feel is important that should be considered as state law. But in those cases, I think it would be best if we had the kind of conversation that we did have when Senate Bill 111 was passed last session, or if we go back a little further than that, when there was talk about mandatory data collection for professional stops, when the race-based policing issue was important, or even last session when we talked about the regulations the police entities should pursue when it comes to investigating missing persons cases. In all three of those, there were really conversations over the specifics of the language. And unfortunately, not being an expert in collective bargaining law, this is a California law, and I'm sure there are a number of very good provisions in this. However, I also know that there's probably some range of provisions that have been adopted through negotiated contracts that may vary, and maybe for good reason as well. It's hard for me to, at this point, anticipate some of that. I have heard concern from, like, Mr. Mackler's counterpart on the management side, which just tells me that a conversation between the two where we could put something together that would really serve the interests of police officers and those that employ them would be helpful. I would say that my experience in the field has been there's a lot less conflict between management and labor in terms of their day-to-day negotiation and involvement with one another. I find that police chiefs that I've worked with have a great deal of concern about their own officers and want to make sure that there's as much due process as possible. I know there are strong feelings and arguments about this. So I guess my bottom line, because I don't want to take too much more of the committee's time, is that if there's a way to bring some of these discussions over putting this kind of language in statute could be brought to at least a discussion. It may be a discussion where at the end of the day I'm not very satisfied with the result, but I'll be a lot more satisfied with that conversation, especially if I believe that we've had the conversation about the implications that language have, which I personally don't have the expertise to bring to this conversation today, but I'd love to bring that expertise together for the purpose. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me come up after I failed to sign up. I appreciate the time and your consideration.
And since I don't have to pay him $400 an hour, I'm going to really use a lot of Representative Barton's time here. Representative Stigler.
Library.
I
guess I'm just curious, and I understand that probably with respect to a good portion of the represented police or public safety officers in this state, this really more or less, you know, understanding more or less is a moot issue. Not necessarily, though, because some of those negotiated contracts are probably not necessarily in line with this. But so what do you do about those police agencies that are unrepresented?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question, and in my conversations with Mr. Mackler and Brian, I believe there's a compelling reason. In instances where someone isn't represented and where there is no way of handling these things because there is no agreement, I think it's pretty compelling to have some kind of standard there. So my argument is not with that those folks that are unrepresented, but for those that are where there is a process already in place and where these things are regularly discussed and bargained, that's more of my concern. So I agree with the question.
Follow up? And in those situations where they are represented, I'm not making a critical judgment with respect to, you know, one way or the other on this, but say that this sort of creates this is sort of the I guess to use the term Mr. Mackler did, the floor of good practice, mm-hmm. In sort of, you know, putting these contracts or these agreements together, then what is the harm?
Representative Barker and Representative Stiegler, the answer to that question is the harm may not be in the objective. It may be in the language. In other words, my concern is this: there may be several things in here that could be completely agreed to without any further revision at all. But I think there are probably a few things in here that could benefit from a full discussion about, okay, what are the implications and where do we have differences? And so I don't disagree, again, with standards. Again, when we went to the Senate Bill 111 use of force bill passage, there were some things that were adopted as a state law in terms of the requirement to have counseling for an officer who's been through that. There were other protections for officers that were adopted in that bill. And those were things that we not only signed off on, agreed to, but supported. And I think there is a possibility for reaching these kind of places of agreement. I prefer if the process was a little different at this point.
Thank you.
It's not right near close to being worked. So. Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2713.
He needs to withdraw his motion to send one of the bills yesterday to look forward to the U.S.
He did resend it then.
There were two.
Okay. Okay. Is there any further business to come before the committee today?
Are we not doing 2463?
No. The 2463 has been moved. Software. Yeah. So we'll come on here.
We'll
okay. Meeting adjourned.